Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is the American love affair with dieting a result of our losing battle with weight control, or is it just a part of our culture? In 2010, hardly a week goes by without a news report about the country's fight against fat. And in fact, more than two-thirds of us weigh more than experts say is healthy. But as my guest today has learned, the country became obsessed with its own eating habits long before the majority of us were overweight. Susan Yeager is an adjunct instructor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University. Her new book is called The 100-Year Diet, America's Voracious Appetite for Losing Weight. Susan, welcome to Think.
Oh, hi, Chris. Thanks so much for having me.
So as early as the 19th century, we started looking not just at the health consequences of overeating, but also to widely perceive it as a moral failing. Can you talk about that?
Yes. The moral failing actually began around 19, or I should say exactly in 1917. Before that, it was okay to have some extra weight. I mean, we had a president of the United States, Taft, who was 300 pounds. We had stars like Lillian Russell, who were very corpulent and considered to be voluptuous and kind of sexy because of that. But in 1917, a doctor named Lulu Hunt Peters, a woman who had been formerly heavy herself, published the first best-selling diet book in the history of the country. It was called Diet and Health with a Key to Calories. Calories, I should mention, were just kind of recently identified as being units of energy at the turn of the century. Well, Dr. Peters published this book. She believed that just about everybody was overweight, although that was couldn't have been further from the truth. Almost no one was. But nevertheless, she thought they were. And at the same time, World War I, of course, got underway. Well, we wanted our soldiers to be well-fed, and now we knew that we could ship calories to them, sugar, fat, not take up a lot of space, ship that to the boys will fight, we will win the war. Let's not help the Hun at mealtime was a big slogan that was plastered everywhere. And suddenly it became treasonous to have a few extra pounds.
Because you were essentially denying a fighting soldier.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. You were a traitor.
So even before that time, we had, for example, this New England preacher, Sylvester Graham, who equated overeating with sexual excesses and any number of vices. Was that a Puritan outlook on food?
Yeah, it was. He was a Presbyterian minister. And, we are and have been for a long time, a very religious country. And Sylvester Graham was in some ways quite correct. He was very suspicious of the Industrial Revolution. He was quite suspicious of white bread instead of whole wheat bread and all kinds of things that now are mainstream. He believed in whole foods long before, it was in any way a catchphrase. But at the same time, he believed spices, meat, needless to say, alcohol, caused people to have lascivious thoughts and to be sexual. For that reason, actually, he hated yeast bread. He thought that yeast breads kind of grew and they were kind of sensual when you needed them and they felt kind of sexy. And for that reason, he developed the Graham cracker.
But it wasn't the cookie-like graham cracker that we feed to our kids today.
No, it was a much healthier graham cracker. I actually found the recipe for it, and no, it wasn't what you would buy in the supermarket today.
How did John Harvey Kellogg gain influence?
Well, now, John Harvey Kellogg, a disciple of Sylvester Graham's, he, too, was a very religious man. His parents were Seventh-day Adventists. That was a new religion at the time. And he was brought up to be a devout Adventist. And the Seventh-day Adventists founded a sanitarium in Battle Creek, Michigan. And he was really raised to head up that sanitarium. He was sent to medical school. He had good training, University of Michigan, Bellevue Medical School, came back to head up the sanitarium. And he, too, believed no spice, no caffeine, no meat. He these were very strict vegetarian diets, actually, and for exactly the same reason as Graham, sexual excess.
And how successful were people at following these ideas they had?
You know, my guess is probably not terribly more successful than people are today. They embrace the ideas. The rich and famous loved Kellogg and loved his sanitarium. Everyone from Rockefeller to, oh my goodness, Thomas Edison, Henry Ford, every famous person of the day practically crossed the path of the sanitarium, and they followed it for a while. They would go there. They would follow his diet. They would maybe lose a little bit of weight. They would exercise. They would think they were doing the right thing for themselves. But very, very often they would then go back to real life, kind of like going to a spa today.
You have to wonder what Kellogg would think about the cereal empire that grew out of his very ascetic ideas about what we should be eating.
I think he would have hated it.
Mm-hmm.
I think he would have really detested it. It was actually his brother who made the cereals as popular as they are today and who started the huge manufacturing companies.
How was food in the early 20th century viewed as something that could help to assimilate immigrants?
Immigrants were viewed with suspicion in the early 20th century. There were the nativists, the people that didn't want immigrants to enter the country. We've had that since the beginning of our country. Whatever group got here first, they felt they were the group, and you know, no one else should come. And then the next group would come, and they were the group, and so forth. And at the turn of the century, of course, we had a lot of Jews, we had a lot of Italians, we had a lot of Irish immigrants, a lot of Chinese immigrants. And those immigrants, they tried, the new nutritionists, the quote, home economists, unquote, tried to get these people to fit into the pattern of the American way of diet. And that was a diet based on science, technology, getting the best, you know, nutritional bang for the buck. You know, nutrition was a brand new science at that time. And it often didn't work very well, you know. Europeans, let's think of Italian people, tend to put a very high price on wonderful food, fresh ingredients, eating well. And you couldn't really tell them that easily not to do this, to change their diet, which actually very often was a very good one.
Yeah, it's interesting to think, too, that as we had more immigrants, they were obviously probably different kinds of bodies moving into the country.
Absolutely. Different kinds of bodies and different types of dietary culture behind those bodies. You know, there was a time, for example, when Jewish people immigrated to the country, many of whom became diabetic. At the turn of the century, there was thought that there was a gene for diabetes. It wasn't connected to diet at all. And who had that gene, ironically, would shift depending on what part of the population happened to have a large amount of people who were diabetic. So it was thought there was a Jewish gene for diabetes. Then there was an African-American gene for diabetes. Oddly enough, it was thought this gene could kind of jump around from culture to culture.
At what point did weight become really a social signal, even more than a measure of relative physical health?
Well, we weren't as a country, and this is an interesting thing, we weren't terribly obese or overweight. In fact, I should say we weren't at all obese and overweight until about the 1970s. It was a pretty plateau, stable level of about 15% overweight and maybe 10% obese, which is, you know, more or less there are always corpulent people. I mean, there was Falstaff in Shakespeare. There were, you know, there are always people who have a tendency to be heavier. It wasn't until the mid-70s, early 80s, that the obesity epidemic started to catch up to us. And the converse of that was, as the country began to get heavier, it began to be more and more important to be thin.
I think it's so interesting that we've been dieting for such a long time, and we started dieting before, as a society, we had a weight problem.
Oh, yeah. Well, the real, as I say, the diving began at around 1917, but it didn't get great impetus until the 30s. Now, think about this. I mean, the greatest depression the country had ever known. People are on bread lines. There are soup kitchens. And yet people that have money, the middle class, the upper middle class, they are going on really bizarre fad diets. That was the start of the loopy fad diets, things like the Hollywood 18-day diet where all you eat is citrus fruit and oranges and, you know, 585 calories of them for 18 days. Who would think to do such a thing? But this was very, we still do, of course, but very popular in the 30s. Banana and skim milk diet, pineapple and lamb chop diet. All of these two food diets became extremely the rage.
I think the most disturbing guru in the entire book for me was this guy named Horace Fletcher. Can you talk about him?
Well, Horace Fletcher was kind of, in a way, like Graham, like Kellogg. He meant well. I mean, he was a kind of a man of the world, very obese. Suddenly he couldn't get insurance. And this upset him, you know, this corpulent man of the world. How can this be? So he did some research, he did some studying, and he came up with an idea that is odd, and yet if you think about it, it would work. He was known as the great masticator. His concept was you had to chew your food and to just gnarl it into a mashy pulp before you could swallow it. He printed up cards saying how much you had to chew every food, at least 100 times, often more than 100 times. He chewed liquids. He chewed everything. He believed that this would cure all social ills, not just obesity, but all problems in society. And it was extremely popular. At the turn of the 20th century, everyone Fletcherized, everyone. I mean, you read about it weekly in magazines, in newspapers. I mean, people like Ford, Rockefeller, Edison, all of the rich latched on to it right away. But so did poorer people. Everyone did. It seemed to make sense to them, kind of the way maybe Atkins made sense at the turn of the 21st.
And I guess if you're chewing everything 100 times, it just you take in less food in a half-hour meal.
That's exactly right. You're taking in a lot less food, so in that respect, it works. You're also going to eat a lot less meat. It caused really another uptick in vegetarian diets because, you know, meat's going to take half an hour to chew with the liquid. So that was another result. And again, that is something, especially fatty meats, highly caloric, and people did lose weight.
At what point, was it the 20s when people started knowing commonly how much they weighed?
The 20s... Yeah, because of a couple of things. Firstly, indoor plumbing. About 50% of the homes had it in the 20s, and that caused all Detecto and a lot of other scale entrepreneurs to make bathroom scales so people could weigh themselves in the privacy of their own bathroom, get undressed, and know what they weigh. At the same time, these scale people put scales everywhere, penny scales on the street, in markets, in department stores. And it was a common practice for people to weigh themselves two or three times a day. Again, taking control of their body. You know, if you don't know exactly how much you weigh, the scale manufacturers would say in their ads, you know, how can you take control?
Susan Yeager is my guest. She's an adjunct instructor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at NYU. Her new book is called The 100-Year Diet, America's Voracious Appetite for Losing Weight. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or emailing think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Hundreds of personal and professional development courses start this summer. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Susan Yeager is my guest. She's an adjunct instructor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at NYU. Her new book is called The 100-Year Diet, America's Voracious Appetite for Losing Weight. Join the conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Susan, the 1930s are really interesting to me because you've just come through this period where everyone started weighing themselves on a daily basis. You have the Depression and people are latching on to these really crazy fad diets. And then you have the rise of soda as the national drink.
Yeah, well, soda, this was a brilliant thing. Particularly the creator of Coca-Cola, which was actually the second major soda creator, Dr. Pepper was the first. Both of them started out in pharmacies. They were medicines. If we think back to the original Coca-Cola recipe, which did indeed contain a tiny bit of cocaine and contain quite a lot of caffeine. Cocaine was used regularly as a remedy for all kinds of health problems until 1914, when it could no longer be sold over the counter in pharmacies. The guy who invented Coca-Cola was a visionary in that he had a sense that prohibition was coming. And he was looking for something to replace alcohol in the American diet. Hmm. And that's really how he marketed and how Coke got its rise and first became so very popular. It captured the nation's heart. It stayed on as, you know, the America's favorite beverage long after Prohibition ended.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're talking this hour about Susan Yeager's new book, The 100-Year Diet. Let's go on the phones to Scott in Dallas. Hello, Scott.
Hi. Yeah, your initial comments kind of maybe led me astray. And that is, I'm real interested in the way ethnic foods came into being. I think I can remember Chinese food was pretty exotic. And now we have Indian food, Mexican salsa, the number one condiment. Mm-hmm. And also interesting, this is kind of different, but how these immigrants come and they're not really familiar with our way of eating and they seem to get fat, you know, where their food might be fatty and rich, but they probably didn't eat as much of it as they did here. And so that gets into, I guess, the cheapness of food.
Yeah, well, you're quite right, Scott. And of course, we're talking about kind of two different things today, let's say, and 100 years ago. 100 years ago, immigrants might come to this country and have their cultural foods, and actually home economists, thinking they were very much doing the right thing, tried to kind of shape them, put them into the melting pot, and get them to eat the way Americans were then eating. Now we have a very different situation. We often have immigrants coming with very good diets of rice and beans and greens and great vegetables and fish and so forth. And they come to America and they want to be Americanized for one thing. And also, as you say, fast food is cheap. And very often, yes, very often people come to America and become obese when they never were before. And it's quite a difficult problem. I mean, children see other kids eating fast food. They want to do it, even though there's a different type of more nutritious food at home. And you know, what do you do? I stopped in McDonald's the other day. I was curious at breakfast time. I wanted to see what they were serving. For $3.99, you could buy the big breakfast. That was eggs, sausages, pancakes, syrup, biscuits, $3.99. Well, if you're an immigrant, not a lot of money, getting started, you know, that's what happens.
I want to talk about World War II. You mentioned the effects of World War I. World War II, of course, we had a lot of rationing in this country that was official. How did that affect our ideas about food and eating?
Well, we actually did better rationing food in World War I when we took it on ourselves to ration the food when it was not official than we did in World War II. Americans were very individualist people, I think. And when we were suddenly told we couldn't have things, that was when we went and we stored it and we stocked up on it. And there were things called food leggers, And these are the people that, of course, sold meat and other restricted items sub rosa under the table. None of this happened in World War One. There was no rationing, and everyone tightened their belt, and everyone tried to, you know, pitch in and help. Once we were told we couldn't have it, that's kind of when people went wild and crazy storing up food. One nice thing that happened to World War II were the Victory Gardens, however, and a huge amount of vegetables were grown throughout the country.
It seems like such a great idea, and yet did those gardens continue after the war ended?
No. That's what's so odd, you know? I mean, here people were gardening. They were using the food at home, great nutritious food. They went to school lunches. It went to feed the poor. They were wonderful things. And yet, when the war ended, the Victory Gardens ended as well.
Another thing that didn't end at the end of the war was the use of amphetamines. Can you talk about how that entered the sort of dieting landscape?
They have come and gone and come and gone and never really gone, I should say. Just different versions have come about since the 30s when they were first discovered. I mean, amphetamines do speed the metabolism. They make your heart beat faster. You do burn up calories faster. There seems to be an endless supply of new ones that come along every time the last one ends up killing people. And this has been going on since the 1930s. I mean, a good slogan for any of them is they may cause you to lose weight if they don't kill you. Hydroxycut, just last year, in fact, was a big pill of this type over the counter, non-FDA regulated, but over the counter pill that killed someone.
So soldiers, for their part, had occasionally been given these in order to stay up in foxholes
Soldiers are given the pills to stay up longer, to be able to concentrate more intensely. Russian soldiers, for example, during the First World War were given these pills to keep them warm, which they do. They do keep you warm. They do all of those things if you manage to stay alive.
Yeah.
But the soldiers were given them, sure, and they came home, and they kept using them. And they got prescriptions, and they gave them to their friends, who gave them to their friends, and so forth. And it continues now. Many, many people, I mean, it is mind-boggling to me that something like 10% or more of Americans have used amphetamines to diet, in spite of the fact that they are deadly.
And you also had this phenomenon at the end of the war of wives and girlfriends dieting for the first time in order to look good for their returning soldiers.
Yeah, well, for the first time, women were told there's a shortage of men. You know, not only is there not enough butter or meat to go around, you know, suddenly there aren't enough men to go around. And so the magazines would say, you know, girls, your men are coming home, and, you know, your guy isn't going to be happy unless you have a perky figure for him. So let's go on a diet and let's lose 10 pounds in 10 days. And again, here's an interesting thing. All of this dieting stopped during the Second World War. You know, we didn't particularly need to lose weight. We weren't overweight as a country. We had a lot more things to concentrate on. There was a moratorium on weight loss. Suddenly, the troops were coming home. Okay, let's all start dieting again. And these loopy, fat, 1,000-calorie, a day diets came back and were very popular.
Susan, why have we always preferred the loopy, fad diets to the tried and true, actual, effective methods of eating less and moving more?
Chris, I've spent so much time trying to figure this out. I have some ideas that have to do with the confusion about how to eat. One month it's low carb, one month it's low fat. This is bad, then something else is vilified, then something else is vilified. Terribly confusing. I think that's a part of it. I think looping all carbohydrates together is probably the worst thing that was ever done to anyone who tried to lose weight, because there are carbs like fruits and vegetables that should be in anyone's diet all the time, And some that you can argue, sure, Coca-Cola, you know, sugary, caloric drinks, that shouldn't be. That's a part of it. The other part is, I think, that it's tough to accept that eating better and moving more is the only thing that works, because that takes a long time, you know? It takes dedication. It takes time. It takes commitment. It can be a lot easier and nicer to think, I'm just going to pop a pill, or I'm just going to, you know, eat cabbage soup for the next 3 weeks.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Nancy in Fort Worth. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I'm really interested in this topic. As a nurse, we're probably the best group study because we are always doing the latest thing in diets. I remember when I was a kid, my mother going on a ketone diet, and she'd be on the stick, and if her ketones were elevated, that was a good thing. Well, we now find out that's a terrible thing. Now, the HCG diet is the biggest new thing. Is there anything that you have to say about that?
I don't, you know, except stay away from it. The ketone, of course, she was trying to control her carbohydrates.
This is the foundation of Atkins, right?
As a nurse. And she might have been on, you know, Stillman's diet or Herman Taller's calories don't count or Atkins. But they're all the same, essentially. Most diets are just variations on very, very few themes. No, I mean, the most I can say about it, and I'm sure the best I can say, and I'm sure you tell this to your patients, is don't do this. I have a relative who is master cleansing.
And this,
I mean,
is this
my
is where you,
relative. I guess.
Is this a liquid? This is a liquid diet, right?
Oh, it's a dandy one. It is cayenne pepper, lemon juice, maple syrup in water, 6 times a day with laxatives.
Oh.
This is sweeping the internet right now because a number of celebrities like Beyonce Knowles and some others are doing it. It's terrible. It's harmful. And this is a very bright woman, by the way, who's doing this.
Well, does that surprise you that it is people who should know better?
Yeah, it does. That's actually why how the book came about. My husband and I have a house on the east end of Long Island, and it was late summer, and a bunch of relatives were coming over for dinner, and one of them is a vegan. And so I had an all vegan dinner, not hard that time of year to do that sort of thing. But two of my relatives came in, my aunt and uncle. Now, I should tell you, one is a psychoanalyst, and the other is a professor at an Ivy League school, very bright, well-educated people. They came in, they looked around, looked horrified, said to me, but there's nothing we can eat. And I said, why? And they said, well, we're on Atkins. Where's the meat? Where's the cheese? And that's what really got me started thinking about this 7 years ago. I mean, why do smart people go on foolish diets?
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Matt in Fort Worth. Hi, Matt.
Hey, Chris. Big fan of the show.
Thank
I was
you.
Calling to ask Susan, your guest, about eating 5 small meals a day. If that's I'm not a picky eater, but I am what I call kind of like a food snob, where I always make sure I'm eating healthy. You know, getting my fruits and vegetables, and you know, a little bit of red meat and a lot of fish and a lot of grains. I don't have 3 big meals a day. I'd rather have, just snack throughout the day, between meals of, high carbs and get that, and then have some smaller meals during the day. And I've noticed that I stay a little bit thinner than my peers who all they eat all they'll eat is like fast food twice a day. Or I just want to know if
great. Your diet sounds ideal to me. Frankly, it sounds. It sounds perfect, and if you're happy having 5 smaller meals a day, that's fine.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Susan Yeager is my guest. Her new book is The 100-Year Diet. Next up, we have Ken in Plano. Hi, Ken.
Yes, hi. I've got a comment leading to a question. I've got letters in my family going back 100 years, all of them writing about how they're worried about their weight, and this led me to a very basic question, and I'll have a comment leading to a question. you know, the evidence is in. Throughout the human experience, I would think that eating too much and eating too little, most human beings have noticed the effect on the body. But I was wondering if you could just comment on or discuss how throughout the centuries, how our understanding of dieting and eating food has changed when the experience of eating and its effect on the body seems obvious or it seems to be evident. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, thanks, Ken. And I wish I had access to those letters when I was writing my book. What you say is quite true. The effect of food on the body has been known for a very long time. I mean, the first actual diet treatise was written in 1757 in London and said essentially what we know now is true. If you eat too much, you will gain weight. If you eat too little, you will lose weight. They didn't yet know what to eat too much of or too little of. And kind of, it was observational. You know, they would look at people who maybe had a lot of dessert or had a lot of very fatty foods and would say, okay, fatty foods cause you to gain weight. Sugar causes you to gain weight. And they were pretty much right. The only way it has shifted, putting aside all of the money that came to be made out of the weight loss industry, this is a gigantic industry now. So there are a lot of people vested in people not losing weight or in helping people lose weight. So it's changed in those two areas. But Ken, you're quite right. I mean, the basics are the basics. If you eat too much, you'll gain.
Susan Yeager is my guest. She's an adjunct instructor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University. Her new book is called The 100-Year Diet, America's Voracious Appetite for Losing Weight. We'll resume our conversation in a moment. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Hundreds of personal and professional development courses start this summer. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is adjunct instructor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at NYU, Susan Yeager. Her new book is called The 100-Year Diet, America's Voracious Appetite for Losing Weight. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. I want to talk about the 1950s, Susan, when the prevailing idea was that obesity must be tied to some kind of psychological problems. Can you talk about the sorts of solutions that were proposed?
Mm-hmm. Well, psychology was becoming extremely important at that time. I mean, people, it became kind of a trendy thing to be analyzed. And as soldiers came back from the war and had very many had some, you know, very serious, of course, problems, there weren't really enough psychologists to go around, and that's how group therapy began. Well, the reason I'm mentioning this is that group therapy translated not too long after that to group sessions for weight loss. That was one way that psychology had a major impact on weight loss. But at that time, you know, right now they all seem cliche, but every psychological concept you could think of was being thrown at someone who happened to be a little bit overweight. You know, they were stressed, so they were eating too much. A woman wanted to be pregnant, so she was heavy so that she would appear pregnant. Or she didn't want to be sexual, so she was heavy, so no man would touch her or go near her, you know. So many of these psychological reasons were attached, and suddenly, if you were overweight, you weren't just, and I mean you know, a few pounds overweight, 10 or 20 pounds overweight, suddenly you were neurotic, and you should be on a shrink's couch because of it.
So do you think that led to everyone being on a diet? And we know so often that diets fail and people gain more weight. Did that desire for everyone to sort of be average cause us to gain more weight?
I think that had a big part of it. Yeah, it had a lot to do with it. Every time, I think that all of these diets caused us ultimately to become heavier and heavier. It's, of course, not the only reason for the obesity epidemic. There are many, many reasons for it, and we can go into that. But when you diet, a fad diet, I'm not speaking of perhaps a Weight Watchers or any diet where you're losing weight slowly and steadily and sensibly, then you're not setting yourself up to fail. But any fad diet, like Master Cleanse we talked about before, or low-carb diets, anything of that sort, you are setting yourself up to fail. You can't possibly stay on the diet for very long. It's torturous. You really are. You're giving yourself fewer calories than a prisoner of war. So, of course, you're going to fall off the diet. You're going to dislike yourself for that. You're going to beat yourself up for it. Your metabolism is going to shift ever so slightly so that you will generally end up weighing just a little bit more than you did before you started that diet. And ultimately, apathy sets in. And apathy sets in and people say, I don't care. You know, life is short and I'm going to eat whatever I want and, you know, pass the pizza and the beer. So, yes, I think that all of these diets did foster, in part, the obesity epidemic. I mean, I think we can surely say they did nothing to help it.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Scott in Dallas. Hi, Scott.
Hi. Yeah. I changed my, I guess, lifestyle and my eating habits, and I've lost more than 100 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things I noticed in doing all of that is how actually difficult it is to cook for yourself in a healthy way, to find foods that are healthy and also reasonably priced. And I'm wondering, you know, why is that? You would think that something that wasn't processed would be less expensive than something that is.
Yeah, you would, wouldn't you, Scott? That's a great question. What happens is that there are a couple of foods in this country, most important ones, corn and soy. These crops are subsidized by the government. Now, 80% of corn and soy doesn't feed us. It does other things. The corn, of course, becomes high fructose corn syrup, which is why Coca-Cola is, you know, cheaper than water. It also, corn and soy both, fatten cattle, feed chickens, which is why, you know, a Big Mac and a Coke is incredibly cheap. Go to McDonald's. A Big Mac and a Coke is going to be cheaper than a salad. So your point is an excellent one, and it would be wonderful if something could be done to subsidize, you know, fruits and vegetables. It would help everybody tremendously, but that's exactly what the problem is.
Is the obesity epidemic also partially a factor of, you know, you mentioned that, you know, hundreds of years ago, people were noting that if you ate too much, you would gain weight. But for a lot of human history, the vast majority of people haven't had the capacity to overeat. They were just barely getting by.
Well, sure. I mean, if you are food insecure or don't have quite enough food, well, certainly obesity is never going to be a problem. But there were so many other things that, you know, if you think of the turn of the last century or even until 75 or 1980 when everything, you know, there was a sea change, really, in weight in America. Before that, so many things. No high fructose corn syrup, no palm oil, none of the things that Scott just mentioned, you know, all of the cheap food and much easier and cheaper to get than wholesome good food very often. But in addition to that, people walked and rode bicycles. They didn't drive. No suburbs, no fast food restaurants, no televisions, no computers. If you did drive, at least you had a stick shift. You know, you were moving a little bit. So all of these streams and currents really came together and started to catch up with us. And of course, it's It doesn't seem to be getting any better. We had plateaued in 2008. The bit of good news was that obesity seems to have plateaued, but the latest Gallup report, and it was a huge survey of thousands of people, seems to be showing an uptick again in obesity levels in every demographic and every age group.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Drew in Irving. Hello, Drew.
Hello. Actually, my question kind of connects to some of the things you've been talking about over the last few minutes. I have ADHD, and both from my personal experience and talking to the doctor, a higher protein diet actually makes it easier for me to deal with things with the ADD symptoms. And I found that cutting out all the high fructose corn syrup, as well as processed wheats and things like that, also helps. So it's mostly a whole grain diet with a higher protein. Where is the borderline between a ketonic diet like you've been talking about with the Atkins diet and still eating the high-protein diet that helps me to actually function better while still eliminating all those, like the high-fructose corn syrup and the processed grains?
Okay, well, firstly, let me say I am not a physician, and you should certainly do whatever your physician suggests that you do. But I think that cutting out high fructose corn syrup, cutting out processed foods, is an ideal thing for you or anyone else to do. And it's amazing how much better you, I, everyone feels when you eat fruits, vegetables, lean meats. There's no reason not to have protein, but just watch what you're eating. You know, have lean meats, have good, organic chicken, have fish, a wonderful source of protein. Just eat better, and eat better is fruits, vegetables, whole grains, lean meats, all of the things you said.
Do you think, Susan, that the foodie movement and the embrace of organic and more whole foods will ultimately pay dividends? It doesn't seem that it's doing so yet, but do you think we're on the right course?
I like to think we are. I kind of love the movement because I think the more we think about what we eat, the better off we all are, the better off the planet's going to be, the better off we personally will be, the better off the food animals will be. It's just win-win all around. And, I like to think we will. I was very disappointed by that latest Gallup survey, quite frankly, but a lot of things are just happening now, and it's quick. We have so many great things happening. I mean, with Michelle Obama's Healthy Kids Initiative and Let's Move, her campaign, that's great. We haven't seen this happen, an American president's family do this since the Kennedy administration. So that's a terrific thing. Seeing calories posted on menus is wonderful. Ban on trans fat is great. All of this, I think, will eventually provide some dividends for us.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time it's Bill in Addison. Hello, Bill.
Hello. All this talk seems to be just adding more to the confusion. If calories are what counts, what's wrong with a 1,000-calorie diet? And keep things simple. Thank you.
There's nothing wrong with counting calories as long as you eat the correct amount for you. I'm not sure of your height, let's say, your size, but I can tell you that unless you are, maybe a 12-year-old boy, 1,000 and a small fellow with that, 1,000 calories is not enough. So if you put yourself on a starvation diet, you are going to be punishing yourself. You're going to be starving yourself. Will you lose weight? Of course. You'll lose weight the same way a prisoner of war will lose weight. But you're not going to stay on that diet. But if you want to say what's wrong with watching calories and getting the right amount of calories every day for my weight and height, you're absolutely right. That's exactly the right thing to do.
Which drives which? Is it marketers drive our compulsion to diet, or is our compulsion to diet just something that lures marketers to try and find something that we'll buy?
That's a great question. I really think it's both. I think we're in kind of this infinity loop. we have all of those food technicians and technologists out there figuring out just that right combination of fat and salt and sweet to cause craveability, to keep us going back to the all the various fast food outlets or buy those center of the supermarket foods. You know, you look at some of those cereals for children, and it just frightens me when I see those packages, you know, and some of them even have positive nutritional things stamped on the front of them, like, you know, heart healthy or a good breakfast or something. But I think in part, yeah, it's the technologists are kind of putting us in this mode where perhaps the calories are, and no one puts a gun to our heads, but still, no one makes it, you know, too difficult to put on the weight either. And then that in turn leads to more people marketing weight loss schemes.
Should we give up hoping that a pill will come out someday that will make it easy for everyone to control their weight?
No, I don't, you know, I have mixed feelings about that. I don't think we should give up hoping it. I think someday it will happen, whether or not it will happen fast. I strongly doubt it's going to happen quickly. I just don't think that we know enough about brain chemistry yet to create a pill that is going to suppress appetite, but at the same time not suppress a lot of the other things that make life worth living. And that's part of the problem. You can suppress appetite. You can make, you know, chocolate cake not enjoyable to eat. But the problem is, if you do that, well, nothing else is terribly enjoyable either. And in fact, there was a pill that was, you know, a great hope was pinned to the drug, but people in tests were committing suicide, and of course it immediately was pulled. But that's the problem. We don't know enough yet to segment hormones that only focus on appetite. So I don't think that's anything we're going to see in the near future.
You write in the book that you've been on a diet since you memorized a little blue calorie counter when you were 12.
I did.
Something that you're now comfortable? Is it not a weight loss diet, but it's sort of a diet to be healthy?
Yeah, I think maybe that was the most fortuitous thing that could happen to me. You know, my mom was of this. I grew up in the 50s and 60s, and my mom had one of those little supermarket counters with the dials, you know, and it told you almost everything had a hundred. It was all in hundreds, you know, like an apple had 100 calories or a large potato had 150 or 200 calories. And I did indeed memorize it, and it stayed with me forever. No, I think it was the best thing that ever happened to me, because I kind of can make these conscious, or maybe I should say subconscious, decisions, and have been doing so all of my life. And,
Susan Yeager,
I'm
so sorry.
Works pretty well.
I'm so sorry, we're out of time. Susan Yeager's new book is called The 100-Year Diet, America's Voracious Appetite for Losing Weight. Susan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. It was great.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.